Very good. Well,
in fact, thank you not only for that opportunity, but for this chance to speak as well. And so I will address work that's published. The work I'll talk about today is based in part on a work that's been recently appeared with his Red Letters. And so without further ado, let me just get right to it and tell you the context in which this work sits. Namely, we have really overwhelming evidence for the existence of non-luminous matter, which interacts apparently through conventional gravitational interactions. And this is observed in astrophysical processes. But to know its nature, then we need to probe it with other sorts of interactions. Namely, we more or less need to assert that it interacts in some manner with standard model particles. We need to know anything about this nature, whether what kind of quantum numbers it has, what kind of basic properties and mass of the individual particles, or even if it is, in fact, constituted of individual particles. And so, in fact, one can look for through direct detection experiments in the laboratory, and also we can look for indirectly through its putative annihilation, once again, to these standard particles. So, very well. But although we know dark matter is non-luminous, we can't really say how dark really is. Namely, what sort of electromagnetic couplings does this dark matter tolerate? And we actually have rather good evidence that dark matter is electrically neutral, but we don't necessarily know whether or not it has magnetic moment. And so let's just say that we don't know how dark matter actually is, and just ask whether or not we can determine through experimental observation what sort of magnetic moment it possibly have. And so the sense of this presentation is to answer this question in the affirmative, that if you say, well, if dark matter happened to have a non-zero magnetic moment, would you know it? Then the answer is, yes, in fact, you could discover whether it had such. I will talk about how that could be solved and two different ways that idea manifests itself. One possible set of measurements are in the context of the study of polarization of cosmic background, and that is, in fact, what my published work concerns. And then another possibility concerns how this idea could give rise to a new sort of terrestrial dark matter experiment. Okay, so very well. And so let me just tell you what I want to tell you. Namely, why would one want to look? It turns out that all models of dark matter are, in some sense, exotic. But the suggestion that dark matter particle could be a non-zero magnetic moment is perhaps more exotic still. Okay, but in fact, I put to you that if you look for the universe you don't know, based on the universe which you do know, then in fact the universe we do know is complex, many particles, many of which have magnetic moments. And so, in fact, when we look at the dark world, then maybe we might be able to impose observational constraints in this quantity as well. And so, very well, that's how we went on to look. I want to tell you a little bit about how exotic dark matter magnetic moment could be, and then tell you a little bit about what limits on electromagnetic interactions already exist. And finally, what is the gyromagnetic Faraday effect? What I put to you is that there is a new sort of magneto-optic experiment, rotation experiment, OBU, that apparently had been discovered in the literature but little appreciated, and that's precisely what will play a role today in trying to elucidate whether a dark matter particle has a non-zero magnetic moment. And so it turns out that we've been studying Faraday rotation in the cosmos since the 60s. It's usually a workhorse technique in radio astronomy to study or measure magnetic fields in the galaxy and beyond. And so I'll tell you a little bit about this usual Faraday effect, which is based on the fact that the medium has free electric charges, and then use that to get a derivation of a Faraday effect in a medium which has electrically neutral but free magnetic moments. And then once I have that in place, I can tell you about how we might use the diamagnetic Faraday effect to constrain dark matter properties, and then gather two different branches. One is through the polarization of the CMB radiation, and the other is through possible terrestrial optical rotation studies. And in this matter, there's been such a lot of press concerning the discovery of the so-called axion in the PBRS experiment done in, I guess, in the mountains of Italy. And what I put to you is that there's an experiment very much like it that one could do to be able to set the possible dark matter magnetic moons. And then finally, what's crucial in this, all this discussion, is how stringent are the tangible constraints. And I'll tell you about that in the context of the CUV studies, and then the terrestrial studies are actually really, you know, is in fact represent more background than here. So, very well. So, once again, I maybe recapitulate what I've already briefly said. Why do you look for a dark matter magnetic moment? Well, in fact, I cannot say too emphatically that all evidence for dark matter comes from astrophysical observation through gravitational interactions. And in that regard, the evidence is quite overwhelming and involves studies of the universe at very different scales. The first the idea itself is this wiki from the 30s, but in fact, the first the evidence, as it were, has snowballed. Studies of Ford and Rubin, of so-called galactic rotation curves in the 70s, suggest that as you map the rotation curve of a galaxy as it goes out from the center, it does not fall off as luminous matter does, but rather it seems to be flat. And you can only explain this if, in fact, there's an additional dark halo. Okay, so this is just a representative plot of this effect, which has been found in many, many galaxies. And in fact, it's not at all special anymore. Now, and turning to the cosmological evidence, then it turns out that there is evidence for a significant omega matter, which cannot be accounted for through observed matter alone. Okay, so in other words, there's a significant dark component to omega matter, and that we can study through the detailed power spectrum anisotropy and cosmic microbacterial radiation, as well as through clustering effects in clusters at low Z, or they say it's typically Z from 1 to 2. And from this, this emerges an overall hypothesis. So very well. So let me just say, as a piece of anecdotal theoretical evidence, that one hopes that, in fact, a theory of particle physics can be concocted to explain this. And in fact, the so-called Wood miracle tells us a single species can reproduce the needed relative density of the Wood masses of order 100 GeV. So in this scenario, there would be a dark universe made of one single thing. Of course, this intellectually is quite surprising, because the universe we do know, this small 5% of mixture, is in fact complex. And so the question is dark matter all one thing? And what in fact could it be constituted? And so, very well, let's consider the possibility that it has magnetic moment. Okay, so very well, but how exotic is a dark magnetic moment? Well, in some sense, all dark matter candidates are exotic. Here's a picture from the Dark Matter Science Advisory report from last year. And so this shows a variety of candidates ranging in mass from 10 to minus almost 30 GeV to 10 to 13 GeV. So they range broadly in mass. Okay. The only thing we really know from trying to understand the nature of large-scale structure and the observation of when the first stars form implies that dark matter really should be composed of should not be relativistic at the time of its decoupling from ordinary matter. So in fact, that means, in the parlance of the subfield, that dark matter ought not be hot. Okay, and so in fact, warm and cold dark matter candidates are tolerated. That means they're simply not extremely relativistic at the time of the decoupling from ordinary matter.
Okay. Moreover,
we believe that it is essentially collisionous, that half suffers from a mutual strong interaction. So we have essentially a non-reactive species, as it were, which is produced in it decouples in a manner so that it's not extremely relativistic. So that being said, those are things that we know in confronting observations of large-scale structure with numerical simulation. So, but you can ask, well, what about these candidates? What are their character? Well, it's very typical to think of one likes to solve as a matter of just a reductionist philosophy more than one problem at once. And wouldn't it be marvelous if one could understand the solution to the hierarchy problem and the nature of dark matter all in one fell swoop? Okay, so that's so. And one possible way to do that is through models with supersymmetry. However, supersymmetry just is its very nature. While you want to map Fermi, have a relationship between fermions and boson particles, and so in fact, it's natural in that context that the fermions be minor on them. And under CPT, these particles have no magnetic moments. So in Susie particles, the realization of dark matter particles' magnetic moments is not at all needed. However, if one takes to heart the notion that Susie is an idea rather than a particular explicit model, that in fact, one can concoct supersymmetric models which do have magnetic moments. And so in fact, it may be quite interesting because this very common way of explaining dark matter doesn't seem to naturally give rise to magnetic moments. So how could you do it? Well, okay, in principle, there are different ways. One way is suggested even by the early review article by Hager and Kane, the notion if you look at the neutrino mass matrix, okay, then there are different free parameters in it. And if two of the neutrinos happen to be degenerate, then you can make a Dirac particle out of them. And that Dirac particle can have a non-Germanic moment. So that's one possibility. And then, in fact, one can think about different extensions, supersymmetric extensions of the standard model. And what possibility is written here, or constructed here by Fox, Nelson, and Dreyer, that actually, in this particular case, they do actually have Dirac genes in that model. So, very well, okay, so those are two options under the context of supersymmetry, which could support non-germanic movement. And then, actually, some people have talked about extra-dimensional models of dark matter, and in this context, then, you could think of, excitations of the standard model brain, which give rise to so-called KK modes, which, in this context, I think are right-handed neutrinos, which serve as a dark matter coordinate, as discussed by Shadal. And so the sense of it is finding that, yes, it is possible to build models which I have on sort of models. Okay, so but nevertheless, this is certainly exotic with respect to the spectrum of these exotic candidates. Okay, but nevertheless, let me just say to you, or tell you, that what we actually know in terms of direct or the kinds of options we have given the nature of dark matter that is so strongly non-interactive, that the manner in which we can actually detect dark matter directly is actually rather limited. And this shows you, if you like, a representative way of getting this dark matter report of the different current options. Generically, dark matter is assumed to couple, either via a scalar interaction, or vis-a-vis some spin-dependent interaction, and plots are shown here. And although the spectrum of theoretical options for dark matter candidates span 30 orders of magnitude, in fact, the window we can actually get in terms of direct constraints based on elastic scattering recoil experiments is much more limited. Okay, so in fact, this window really centers around the 100 GeV range. Okay, so that's fine because, after all, what Miracle tells us that we would hope or expect perhaps 100 GeV dark matter candidate, and in fact, these experiments are meant to discover precisely that. nevertheless, if one takes the perspective that we don't really know what dark matter is, then it's interesting to devise completely different methods which would be sensitive to or operating in a very different window of parameter space. So, okay, that's precisely what I will offer to you. And so, very well. And so let me tell you a little bit about existing limits on the dark matter magnetic moment. So in fact, the spin-dependent interactions can be used to set a limit so this is work by Pokhlad and Tavalus. And so if I work in terms of the nuclear magneton, then in fact the limit is set on the Wood mass, on the magnetic moment for Wood mass of hydrogen is roughly 10 minus 4. And so this is just using, the limits on the recoil signal. Of course, they actually claim a signal, but nevertheless, if you use the size of that effect as a limit, the same as you discover that this is just a sense of the sensitivity, then this is the value of the energy. Now, there was a recent study by Sigerson et al. And a bunch of people on how various cosmological or astrophysical constraints, rather, can constrain dark matter electric magnetic moment as a function of mass. And in fact, that's presented here. It's a little bit problematic because they studied both electric and magnetic dipole moments in the paper. And the sense of this erratum, unfortunately, is to say that they misapplied the direct detection results, and they, unfortunately, did not write down the correct formulae for the magnetic dipole moment annihilation. And so, in fact, unfortunately, it's very embarrassing, but this figure is not correct, and the erratum was only to say was that it was wrong, and that they were going to write a whole new paper, but in fact, had not yet done so. Okay, so, but nevertheless, this is the literature. Therefore, it's appropriate to speak of it.
Would such a dark matter decouple at the same epoch because of the magnetic moment?
The magnetic moment interaction is still a rather weak interaction. I think it doesn't fly in the face of any constraints from large-scale structure at all, because after all we concluded from that was that it didn't interact strongly. So it's
not right. Large-scale structure, when the dark matter decouples.
Yes.
Then the rate of interaction and the rate of Hubble expansion is what you're comparing. And I'm wondering whether it decouples at the same time, because there are all those charged particles which are probably zipping around, carrying currents, and then they're hitting these magnetic moment stuff, and they'll be scattering off them some other way, not just weak interaction. Or am I not understanding at all?
Well, it's an interesting point of, how non-interacting must dark matter be for the standard full dark matter paradigm to emerge. I think it's a correct statement that all that's excluded is the existence of strong interactions. And so that there isn't anything at all out of order with this essential premise. So, but again, only someone who actually does numerical simulations of large-scale structure.
No, I'm not talking about large-scale structure at all. I'm talking about the early universe, as the universe cools, and you're saying certain cross-section. If it has a certain cross-section for interaction, then it decouples at a certain epoch.
No, I understand that. But in fact, the only reason we know, why does it matter where it decouples a particular epoch? Well, the one particular robust consequence of that possibility is what in fact is the nature of large-scale structure. That's why I answered.
But I'm just saying omega dark matter will be
the relic
affected.
Density.
Relic density will be affected depending upon when it decouples.
I'm sorry, I misunderstood the sense of your remark. But you see, it goes to finally, yes,
how do the particles actually annihilate, and what is the mechanism, okay? And finally, what is the mass of the particle as well? Because typically, the abundance is going to be sensitive to the mass of the candidate particle also. And in fact, you raise an excellent point, because I want to put to you that I want to consider a non-zero magnetic moment for light particles. So in fact, you're anticipating at what I'm going to eventually say.
Okay, so you change the mass. Okay.
Well, I'm going to talk about the mass, and in fact, the relevant objection to this is
that will ask your structure. Because once you lower the mass, the random velocity will be larger.
But it can still be.
Warm dark matter, really. Okay.
I'm going to tell you. Yes, it's going to be a warm dark matter candidate.
Yeah.
And yes, there's going to be. We have to worry about how effectively annihilate the particles.
What is the W mass constraint?
Pardon?
What is the W mass constraint?
This is what I'm going to tell you about. And the pity of it is that, so they wrote this around to say that unfortunately what they published was not correct, but that they said that this bound is still correct. This is what they said is still fine in their erratum. And in fact, it's operationally of relevance to us because for a light mass particle, which is what I'm going to tell you about, then in their picture, it looks like it's going to be the most severe constraint. So let's consider that further. Okay. I jumped too many figures. Okay. Nevertheless, irrespective of their erratum, let's just say that their figures are reliable to the sense that at least that apparently for light dark matter, the best measurements will come from precision electroweak constraints. And this W mass constraint of which they speak is in fact precisely how the observed W, Z masses and alpha and G Fermi all conjoin. And in fact, what's relevant about this relationship is that it's modified beyond tree level by rated corrections, which are computable in the standard model. We can confront those rated correction calculations with experiment. And the difference is, if you like, the space we have in which new physics can operate. Okay, and so I have difficulties with this paper. Unfortunately, I cannot. This is what they claim is the bound of RU from these two particular statements of data.
This would mean that they need to assume something about the interaction of the dark matter candidate with the Z.
No, actually, it turns out that in this delta R, there are different pieces to it. Mm-hmm. And what we're going to focus on is the relative alpha.
Okay.
So fine. But nevertheless, you can calculate this. You can compare it with experiment, giving experimental measurements of all these quantities. And this is the limit on new things. Okay. And so, fine, let's go off and pick up. Turns out that they did not actually state sufficient detail to reproduce their calculation. So I used another work by some of those co-authors in another paper, and this was their claim form for delta R. Okay, if the dark matter candidate has mass much less than zero.
Okay.
And so, in fact, they define this so-called M effective parameter, which has embedded into it both the magnetic and EDM coupling of the dark matter candidates to photons. And so this is their form. Okay? The sense of it is finally that if I take their value of RU and their claimed form, I don't get precisely a numerical result. And if I repeat the calculation using their particular interaction, Lagrangian, and then repeat the result, I get the same form in terms of basic parameters, but I have different factors different, and I have a logarithm as well. I was not able to settle this point with direct interaction with them. So nevertheless, I simply am in disagreement with them,
And if I use the most recent value of delta R mu from the particle data loop, and this is the bounds, I guess, on the work of Erler and Langacker, then I have this result, and then I can go off and calculate what the limit on mu is as a function of mass. Okay, and the limit you get is actually relatively insensitive to the mass of the dark matter particle as long. For this light regime. And the pity of it is you take this limit at face value, then this constraint actually rules out the magnetic moment of the neutron, which is rather unfortunate. We know that, in fact, the neutron has a significant magnetic moment to many signals. So, okay, apparently, that these position electrical constraints on the dark matter magnetic moment can, in fact, be evaded. And the neutron itself suggests one possible way how. That is, we want to evade this limit through compositeness. So very well, let's do it. Okay, so I just include a form factor at the relevant vertex. And so I include a compositing scale, 10 GeV, vary the mass of the Canada particle, and yes, as I dial, I can weaken the mass of the constraint considerably. And so here, even for the light particles that we have, we can the constraint on the magnetic moment. Okay, so and so in fact, if I just vary this composite scale, then I can make this as weak as I want. And let me just say that in fact this delta R quantity has other pieces in it other than just one in the alpha. Okay, and you can imagine that there could be other ways, maybe admittedly more convoluted ways of relaxing these position metric bounds. Okay, but nevertheless, let's try to consider or return to the notion of how we might constrain the dark magnetic moment directly. Okay, so this comes back to this Faraday effect. So to set the stage, let me tell you a little bit about the electric Faraday effect. And the sense of it is that a medium of free electric charges, which is the interstellar medium, becomes circulated by a refrigerant if its ferromagnetic field phi is equal to zero. And so the line one for this effect is simply the Lorentz force law. And so an electron suffers a displacement as per the applied electric field and applied magnetic field. And so here we operate in a system where there's an external magnetic field applied only. And in fact, if I solve for the displacement of the dark medium, or in this case, of electrons in the interstellar medium, with an applied magnetic field, then the sense of circular by refringent is that the effective speed of light in the medium depends on its polarization. That is, or rather, its helicity. So that right-handed light travels at a different speed than left-handed light.
See, Susan, the H0 and H0 is the applied magnetic field. Which one is the applied
magnetic field? So the H0 is the external magnetic field.
External magnetic, and H is the one that's generated by the medium.
But actually, this is the magnetic field carried by the photon itself. So the point is that let me align the photon momentum with the external magnetic field. And so the sense of it depending on the velocity of the photon, then the orientation of it, along with the photon magnetic field is different. I mean, how to say it has a different impact in this Lorentz formula. Okay. So finally, I solve for the induced electric susceptibility in this medium is the deviation from the medium controlled by the plasma frequency, and then interestingly, the ballistic correlation is controlled by the amorphous this just E H naught of M is essentially just the cyclotron frequency, where it has that structure. Okay, and so in fact, the Faraday rotation emerges because you imagine you have a photon entering or a light entering this medium. You break it up into right and left-handed circular state of polarization, which propagate at different rates in the medium.
And so if you start with linear polarized light, which is 50% right and 50% left at the beginning, then as it travels through a medium, there is a phase lag. And the Faraday rotation is associated with that phase lag upon transit from that medium upon exit. Okay, so this is the Faraday rotation angle. And interestingly, it's chromatic. It depends on the frequency of the light. So, okay, so you can have, finally, if you look at linear polarized light, propagates in the direction of the extraordinary field. You integrate, okay, along the path the light suffers. So, in fact, the total rotation angle is just the uniform of electron density times the extraordinary field integrated over the line of sight. Interestingly, in radio astronomy, we also have the option of studying pulse sources, for which it is also possible to observe a so-called time delay. This is, in fact, just sensitive to the overall holistic independent effective speed of light in the medium. And here, this is a calculation of the time delay. It's sensitive to the number of density of particles in the medium only. And in fact, there have been the Faraday rotation in radio astronomy was first discovered in the 60s, and now we have surveys of hundreds of different radio pulsars, and we study the Faraday rotation and the time delay and use this to map electric and magnetic fields and star forming regions and so on. And let me just say that the presence of this frequency dependence means that knowledge of the source polarization is completely unnecessary. You simply measure the polarization of the light and then measure the polarization as a functional frequency, and then the coefficient of that dependency really allows you to read off the line of the rule of n times h and n itself. So, very well, and let me just say, this is a huge effect. The number density of electrons is a few times 10 minus 2 inverse centimeters cubed. And so, and for typical radio astronomy wavelengths, this phi is order tens of radians. So, very well. So, this is a big effect, it's studied. So, let's consider another one. Now, if you remember your Feynman, or if you teach undergraduate electricity and magnetism, you know that anything that you write down for E and D immediately maps. There's a magnetic analog always. So anything which is true for E and D is also true for H and D. And so it's natural to expect that there should be a purely magnetic analog of the usual Faraday effect. And in fact, it's true. Okay, Feynman did not mislead you. And so, in fact, you can write it down immediately, okay? And in this case, a medium with free magnetic moments can become circularly required fringent as well if the external magnetic field is non-zero. But there's an actual hitch. The additional hitch is quite important that this medium with free magnetic moments actually possess a magnetization and that orientation upon application of the external magnetic field. Now, I tell you that this, as far as I can tell, is due to Holder. Okay, but in fact, this effect that I'm going to tell you about has never been directly observed in the laboratory. Okay, so in fact, one can ask about proof of principles, experiments, etc. But nevertheless, that's a separate point. Line one in this regard is the Lamoille precession formula. And so here, and then when it's relevant, we have this notation H0 for the prime external magnetic field, and M0 is the magnetization that applies results in application of external magnetic field alone. Okay, and so finally you just solve this differential equation, it's quite straightforward. And in fact, the median is paramagnetic, okay, this deviation from the vacuum value and the permeability is greater than 1. Okay, and in fact, in this regard, this object, okay, is, actually it should be a little bit careful. The sign of this isn't terribly clean, okay? So the, because the one, in fact, there's a holistic state-dependent correlation also here. And so again, this will, the effective speed of light in the medium will depend depend on the velocity of the photons. And so I can, once again, go expand and calculate what the Faraday rotation looks like. Okay, so let me do so. Okay, and it turns out this object omega h, just gamma times h, it really is the typical cyclotron frequency. When this ratio is almost always extremely, it's very hard to break, let's say, for almost any conceivable experiment, omega h over omega is going to be an extremely small quantity. So we can actually calculate the difference of wave numbers to reorder this effect, and also the average, because this deviation of the average from the typical omega C formula will give us a time of wave also. Okay? But nevertheless, this is what's going to contain our Faraday rotation formula in the order. And what's interesting about this is that it doesn't have any manifest frequency dependence. And also, it contains the magnetization in the medium induced by the external magnetic field also. Okay? So that's a quantity that I'll call M0. And the question, what is it? And so I'm going to assert, okay, and we'll see in a second whether it's really true, but I'm going to assert that we're going to have spin 1/2 dark matter particles. I'm going to say it's a thermal equilibrium. I'm going to apply the Boltzmann formula without a care at this moment, just to see what the result looks like. Okay, so finally I get this famous formula where I get the magnetic moment times the number density times a hyperbolic tangent of UH over KDT. Okay? And so if I work from a limit where UH is small compared to KDT, which is again almost invariable in good approximation, I can get a formula for the time delay, which is actually dramatic, and for the Faraday rotation angle, for which has an achromatic piece, namely a piece which does not depend on frequency. And if you work out the numbers, okay, it turns out that the additional factors, gamma, the quantities which are all frequency dependent, trivially small, and so the only effect could be of any practical relevance is this frequency independent polarization of the rotation. And so if I say that the temperature in the medium doesn't depend on line of sight, then in fact there's a common interval between the gyromagnetic and gyromagnetic Faraday effects. So in fact, if I assume I have a common number density and magnetic field in the medium, then I can compare the raw size effect by simply looking at the two prefactors. So let me just do it. I emphasize, we already know the magnetic fields. Magnetic effects are typically much smaller than electric fields. Electric effects was to see how small. Okay, so for electrons, in fact, it's orders of magnitude smaller. Okay, so this is just simply not physics to study in our galaxy. These effects are going to be much too small. However, okay, so this, if you like, is simply not going to play a role for electrons in your star medium. However, okay, these effects can be much bigger for dark matter. Why? Well, dark matter is denser. There's more of it. It can clump. Also, we can include the Faraday rotation of the cosmological wind scales. That's also going to make the effect much bigger. Now, I also put to you that we don't really know anything about the individual, we have very weak constraints, but I think it's correct. We don't know anything, really, about the mass of individual dark matter particles. And this is a fact which scales strongly with the mass. The lighter the mass, the bigger the effect. And so, in fact, lighter candidate particles will give larger rotations for a fixed magnetic moment. Point. Okay? So, let's consider warm dark matter. There's been some observational suggestions from the interval satellite. We look at positron emission from the galactic bulge in our own galaxy. There's some suggestions that maybe there's a light, warm, I mean, a warm dark matter can explain that anomaly.
I say this because I think it's just a suggestion which is interesting. I don't know if there's been lots of discussion about the astrophysics associated with quantum emission, whether it's reliable, kind of this being, how to say, the issue being resolved through such exotic means. Let's just set that aside and say that people discuss warm dark matter candidates. Let's consider the kind of cosmological constraints that are possibly important here, and then try to figure out how we can study this possibility in the context of this very effect.
Well, by the way, in the radio astronomy observations, this DC shift is not possible to measure because
exactly. Right, because so thank you for understanding my time.
Thank you.
No, because in fact, when I told you about the Lepre Faraday effect, it's crucial that it depends on frequency hertz, because we don't know anything about the polarization of individual pulsars. They're just not known. But in fact, the whole point, the reason it's lovely, is it just doesn't matter, because you vary the frequency. You look at and you measure the coefficient of the frequency dependence. So for this Mann-Faraday effect, the only possibility, the only thing we can reasonably do, we have to go to a light source of known polarization. And so I think you might be able to guess where I'm going to go next with that. But but nevertheless, let's just say that yes, we have to adopt a source of known polarization. But, okay, since you asked this other shrewd question, I get to say, well, as soon as I consider a light dark matter candidate, lighter than a few GeV, then I have to worry about how that I don't make too many of them, okay? And so the point finally is that if I imagine the dark matter just interacts weakly, then the annihilation section times the velocity is the relevant parameter to the relic density. And that quantity, if given just conventional V minus A weak interactions, will look typically like G Fermi squared times candidate mass squared. So as the particle becomes lighter for conventional weak interactions, weak interactions are much less effective at annihilating these particles. So the sense of this famously Weinberg constraint, it's from 77, and unfortunately we're back down the records, is that if the particle is too light, the conventional weakener annihilation mechanism just simply doesn't operate, and you overclose the universe, and that's completely unacceptable. However, if you consider warm dark matter, which has a magnetic moment, then it can annihilate through a different pathway. And isn't it lovely? Magnetic moment of annihilation will be controlled by alpha times magnetic moment squared, which depends like inverse the mass. So in fact, it's acceptable to consider a magnetic moment annihilation mechanism for a light candidate particle. Now, I would say that Bohm et al. Proposed MEV dark matter candidates to extend integral single. Her first favorite candidate is a scalar dark matter candidate. She has a different mechanism to evade the Lee-Weinberg constraint. So in fact, but nevertheless, it's possible to construct models which are light and compatible with that constraint. Okay, so very well. So we're going to consider light dark matter. We're going to give a magnetic moment. And the question is, how do you constrain it? Okay. So, well, the very nature of the Faraday effect we consider is that in order to realize a constraint, we have to use a photon source of known polarization. And so the only possibility that's relevant to us is the polarization of cosmic microwave. So what is that? Okay, so let me just set it up. I mean, in the universe, okay, photons and electrons are strongly coupled. Okay, and then as the universe cools, eventually the electrons and protons are combined to make neutral particles. And at some point, okay, the photons from the Big Bang decouple, okay, and we see them. Okay, that is to say, They scatter strongly with electrons in the universe. Slowly, the electrons and protons combine. So at some point, the photons of the cosmic microwave background see some surface of last scattering. And it turns out that the large preponderance of the photons we detect in this remnant radiation actually suffered their last scattering at Z of roughly 1100. So this is really far back in the past. And the question is whether the nature of that last scattering can induce polarization with background radiation or not. And the marvel of it is the answer is yes. If the microwave background radiation were completely isotropic, then there'd be no polarization effect at all. However, if the microwave background has an isotropies in it, okay, in particular, if it has a quantical anisotropy, then in fact scattering, quantum scattering, can generate that polarization. So this is roughly expected to be operative around the 10% level, okay? And the polarization that's operative that emerges from that is so-called emo polarization. And it's described in this way because of the correlation of that polarization with regard to hot patches in an anisotropic sky. So perpendicular to that sense of polarization is something I'll call the Beagle polarization. And so in an inflationary universe, then you expect overwhelmingly ego-type polarization. There are different ways of getting the other polarization state, okay? And so they're countable, actually. One of them is very interesting. It's a primordial source that comes from gravitational waves, and that's actually a big focus and big interest in measuring this. But let's just think about Beagle polarization in this context. The sense of it is you start with pure E-type polarization, then the Faraday rotation will induce a small bit of the other spin state. So in fact, this is a Faraday effect which is not dependent on frequency, which induces Beagle polarization. So that's how it could work. And so the search, what you want to look for then, is frequency independent BB correlations in the cosmic microwave background. That's the signature for this.
But you need either primordial fields or intergalactic medium fields.
You need primordial fields as a necessary condition, and I will explain that to you. However, okay, now so maybe it's just, you know, happy fine-tuning that this talk occurs during the Dynamo program here at the KITP. But nevertheless, let's just say that there is, it's clear that in order to make this work as a cosmological signal, you have to have a non-zero primordial magnetic fields. We have limits on it, okay? Not all bet them. Okay. So very well. So it's interesting, okay, to look at this particular. This is an So this is what we want to look for. Okay. Let me just say the notion of having achromatic EV correlations is not unique in and of itself. Okay. That is to say, it is known that gravitational forces can produce that such effect also. However, gravitational lensing effects also impact the temporal correlations as well. So this is, if you like, intrinsically distinguishable because it's an EV correlation which has no temperature correlation analog. So it's potentially distinguishable from gravitational lensing. And it's an interesting thing. It's essentially intrinsically a final state interaction because as far as we know, the early universe, the radiation in it, et cetera, respects parity. So to induce correlation of the spill necessarily speaks to a final state interaction effect. So it makes an interesting null test. So very well. So I put to you as distinguishable, OK?
okay? And that, let me just say that all these cosmological studies of the polarization of CMB are tough. Okay, we actually have observed CMB polarization, but even the most recent observational data just give limits on CMB polarization. So if the overall polarization of the cosmic microwave background is about 10%, B mode effects are expected to be down by the extra order of magnitude. And actually, there's non-trivial things going on here with actually seeing cosmological B mode polarization. One has to remember that typically we believe we see photons from the last scattering surface, namely of Z1100. By the late times, the universe reionizes, and as soon as there's new free electrons, then photons and electrons couple once again. And in fact, this later reionization interaction could obscure the cosmological signal. So that's just a statement, okay? But that is a significant, no more so for this effect than searching for signatures of primordial gravitational waves. Okay, so that's just a remark, okay? And so on we go, and we have to consider how we might magnetize dark matter in the universe. Because in the magnetic field of Faraday effect that I'm telling you about, it's important that the medium have a net magnetization. And so that's important. So let's think about how it actually works. It turns out that if you imagine a dilute gas and you apply a magnetic field, the theorist in us would immediately want to write down the Boltzmann formula for the magnetization, and we would be dreadfully wrong. Because it turns out in certain systems, their approach to equilibrium is absurdly slow. And in fact, a system of dilute spins is one particular example. That is to say, if I ask how do I polarize a system, how does it approach equilibrium? Well, it emits magnetic dipole radiation. So the rate for that process is crucial. And if I calculate it, then it's fantastically small. Oh my goodness. If I say that I have, let's be generous and say our magnetic moment is introduced by electromagnetic loop effects, okay? So let's just say that. Let's say we have a microgauss magnetic field, which is typical in interstellar medium, and then calculate the rate. Well, the inverse time scale here in far exceeds the lifetime of the universe. So this is not how you do it. And in fact, we have to turn to how we actually polarize systems in terrestrial laboratories to know how we're going to polarize dark matter. In terrestrial laboratories, we polarize systems through collisions. We polarize helium-3 in a cell of 10 atmospheres. Okay, so it's important to polarize systems through collisions. And so how are we going to magnetize dark matter at all? Well, we're going to have to do it while it's still in thermal equilibrium in the early universe. Okay, so in principle, the idea is that is having dark matter and matter in an electromagnetic field while it's still dense and can collide with other polarized particles that's going to magnetize dark matter, if it works at all. So,
but then you'll have a coherent scale for the magnetization of the order of the Hubble radius at that epoch. And so your chi will be randomly shifting when you want to look at effects on that.
Well, in fact, I want to tell you that there's a very interesting point there. And I hope I'll address it when I say that. Okay, that is to say that, and so the question is, what is the primordial field? What's its coherence length? And when I magnetize dark matter vis-a-vis this primordial magnetic field, what happens to it as the universe evolves? Well, okay, so let me answer the question of what this primordial field strength is. I can tell you from my numerical estimates, I use the limits that people extract from non-observation of Faraday rotation of high Z quasars. Okay, so in principle, that the limit you can give the magnetic field, the coherent over the present horizon, etc., that's the limit I use. So I think I've gained your objection. Okay, now The remark, though, is that, so I manage, say I polarize dark matter. The question is, so I polarize it. What happens to it? Well, again, we can turn to terrestrial systems and ask, well, how well can you maintain polarization in a terrestrial system? Well, what matters is how rapidly you change the magnetic field. So if I start with the magnetic field in the early universe and say, well, how would that putative cosmological or primordial magnetic field evolve with the scale factor of the universe? Well, Gauss's law tells us that, in fact, the magnetic field today will go like the original magnetic field down by 1 over this, it'll be 1 over the, it'll go like inverse the scale factor squared. And so the point is that when, so the electric magnetic field will go, the primordial magnetic, so the magnetic field today is weaker, it was stronger in the past. And the sense of it is that when I ask, well, how the magnetization changes, then I have to just look at dHdt, okay? Because what matters is whether or not the normal precession frequency is fast compared to the time scale over which the magnetic field varies. And as long as the precession is fast with respect to the change in the magnetic field, then you can have what is termed in AMO parlance, adiabatic steering of the spin. Okay, so you start out with spinning magnetic field, it has some net polarization, some projection along the z-axis, and then you change this magnetic field slowly, the polarization can track. Okay? Now here, relevant time dependence of the magnetic field is set by the expansion of the universe. So h dot over h is set by the Hubble constant itself. Now let's think about the frequency associated with the Hubble constant. It's 71 kilometers per second per megaparsec. So in fact, the frequency associated with h dot is fantastically small, and that in fact it's very easy to generate, you know, essentially anything we're going to consider in terms of what a mega cyclotron is going to be big compared to this change in the magnetic field. So, okay, you have the leap of faith here is, are there non-zero primordial magnetic fields? We have never established them. They are only limits. However, if they exist, then it's reasonable, and if you really do magnetize the dark matter, that the system is dense enough and interacting enough to polarize it, nevertheless, you can maintain it as it undergoes cosmological expansion. So the sense of this is that it maybe is not crazy, and that if you actually see a non-zero frequency-independent EB correlation, everything survives the removal of gravitational lensing, then you can attribute it to dark matter.
And how strong are the fields?
The limit comes, there are different limits. There are limits on the distortions of the CMB spectrum, and there are limits on from non-observation of Faraday rotation from light from distance quasars. And the limits in both cases are either 10 to minus 8 Gauss or 10 to minus 9 Gauss. Quoted in today's...
How does it translate into an energy splitting between dark matter in one orientation versus another?
Oh, it totally depends on the candidate mass and coupling. Yeah. It's going to be mu h.
Yeah, right.
So in fact, the splitting... Well, so, okay, well, oh, wow. So it is going to be, well, it's really, really small.
if it's small compared to the, how early are we talking about?
When it's still coupled. I mean, so to magnetize it, it's when it's still coupled to dark matter, I mean, to ordinary matter.
So isn't that energy difference small compared to the temperature?
Probably it is, yeah.
And it's going to be then you're not, then you're dead, right? Then the states will be pretty much
dead. Just all I'm saying is it's a really small number. It's not that it's definitely zero.
Yeah, but you're not, but then the characteristic energy, thermal energies would.
So in fact, so finally, I mean, so yes, it's true that mu h over kBd is a small number, but and that's what's relevant to the final polarization, but it doesn't mean that it's identically zero. I mean, that's why I need to prove the effect of a cosmological distance to see anything at all. So I'm not claiming that it's a big polarization. It's very small one, but it's not identically zero.
So how much is the CMB B mode polarization do you produce in some typical scenario?
Well, you know, here in this case, I need to calculate the rotation angle. I mean, that's what's going to be the new B mode signature. That's going to be its strength. And so maybe without further ado, I should just show you that result.
Yeah.
Okay, so my computer. So what we conclude from this discussion is that any primordial magnetization of the dark matter is extremely small. Okay, and but that we would like to know numerically what kind of effect it's providing. Okay, so in order to do this, it's going to be crucial to integrate over the past light cone of the photon. Okay, so it's going in our effect. Okay, we're going to have to, well, so let me just say that we have to do that with a great deal of care in an expanding universe. And so the photon still follows null geodesics. And so, in fact, it turns out that the original interval I had over path, which was over the number density of the system, okay, becomes really just the path past light cone time. So in fact, I integrate from zero to z in the past of dz over h, where the h is the Hubble parameter of a particular scale. And then I also have to include the fact that the cosmology, this density n, evolves with the cosmology. And so this is the effective quantity that I need to calculate, presuming that the z depends and everything else cancels. So this estimate is going to be numerically very crude, so let me just assert that any relativistic effects in the evaluation of h over t are trivial, and for cold dark matter, I can say that the matter is non-relativistic, and the Bayes and Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution, then the scale dependence of h over t actually finally cancels. And so the only z dependence that remains is here. And so I can calculate the h of t using by solving the Friedmann equation, using parameters as established by WMAP, so a study of flat, lambda, cold dark matter cosmology, and solve this equation. And so, very well. So I calculate this, and I calculate the total Faraday rotation that's accrued by photons traveling from the last scattering surface to the present epoch. And then the big question comes from, we have to use the gravitational inflow velocity. Well, I need to estimate the temperature of dark matter today, and so this is very uncertain, so I'm going to just, to get a number, let me say that I'll use the gravitational impulse velocity of galactic dark matter and assume a Maxwell-Boltzmann distribution for that, which is in I guess, astrophysical parlance, is often called just the isothermal sphere. And so if I do that, then I can link the typical RMS velocity of the dark halo, okay, to T over M. So
So if I say 200 meter kilometers per second for that number, then and I assert a particular mass candidate, and I can get a temperature. And so away I go and I calculate this. Okay? Again, you can see this is really going to be a small number. It enjoys enhancement for a very lightweight candidate particle. And then it's enhanced because it accrues from a cosmological distance. Now, so the point here is I would like to know what kind of limit on mu I can get for a particular non-observation of rotation to a particular level of sensitivity. So, okay, current measuring capacity from experiments such as quad give potential measurements of this angle of order 10 to the minus 2 radian. Okay, hopefully it could eventually do better, but let's say that's so. And then one can try to see what kind of limit is that, and in fact it's a limit that set is only of the order of 4 magneton scale for a light candidate particle. This is like 50 kV. And so this is a grossly uncertain estimate, but nevertheless, a new magnetic moment of this size is not yet ruled out by other data. So that's the sense of it. Okay. But nevertheless, there are a number of points in which this estimate is unsatisfactory. Of course, one has to rely on these bounds on primordial magnetic fields. And the estimate of the temperature of the dark matter is quite uncertain. So let's see.
By the way, the temperature you need not take to do with galactic thing because it's the cosmological signal you're looking at. And once the dark matter decouples and it's at some random velocity, that's just going to redshift. That's all that's going to happen. Until it falls into potential wells, its temperature is not going to increase. And since all your things are going concentrated on the uniform background stuff.
Right.
So you have cold stuff.
Okay. So I don't know. No, it's just that I need to make a number. I need to estimate.
Yeah, it just goes down as expansion factor squared, the temperature of any massive particle due to expansion.
Okay.
And you already start with Fallis. With wherever you decouple, you just go as expansion factor squared.
Okay, so
just like the photon frequency redshifts as 1/1 expansion factor.
Right.
Non-relativistic particle velocity will redshift, and the temperature goes as square of the velocity. And so it just goes down as 1/1 expansion factor squared.
Okay,
so
you'll
get a stronger limit there.
So you're saying that I should be able to get, I get something much colder, and I'll be able to get a better number. Quite possible. Okay, I would like to talk to you more about it later, but nevertheless, okay, it's clear that this estimate has uncertainties embedded into it. And you know, how much time do I have? I'm almost done. So I just want to tell you about this other possibility. And so it's clear that these kinds of limits are, I mean, cosmological studies are difficult observationally and subject to gross uncertainty. And so let's consider whether or not we can limit the dark matter magnetic moment or fugitive one for a terrestrial study. So there are obvious advantages. We can apply magnetic fields of known strength. Measurement of small rotation angles are possible. And we notice that although current technology is challenged by 10 to the minus 2 radian measurement of the polarization of the cosmolike background, meaning that precision, that in terrestrial experiments we measure rotation angles, or it is established we can measure rotation angles of 10 to minus 8 radian. Okay, so we can do much better. And then also, Faraday rotation accrues coherently under momentum reversal. So you can imagine mounting an experiment in a cavity with high Q value. Okay. And then finally, if you take the notion that dark matter is non-interacting, conventional vacuum patterns rely on, they pump conventional matter by dint of its strong reaction or electric charge. And so vacuum pumps, you can imagine having an evacuated cavity. It's ordinary matter free, but dark matter can sweep through it. Okay. And so in order to set the stage, I'm doing the wrong thing. Okay. So let me consider this PVLES experiment, okay, which eventually was retracted. But nevertheless, the point is, what kind of technical capacities do they have? Okay, so we can look at the total photon interrogation time, which is still a millisecond time scale, the applied magnetic field, which is 5 Tesla, and the ability to measure the photon polarization, which was at 10 to the minus 8 radian precision. And in fact, David Booker tells me that you can do much better than measuring the photon polarization. It's simply a counting experiment, and so we can talk about that. You can use, maybe just, well, I guess you use a brighter laser or simply still interrogate the system longer. Okay. And so finally, let me just say that if we do this experiment, okay, one particular concern is what the primordial dark matter magnetization might be. Okay. And so in fact, if we could polarize dark matter in the laboratory, that would be much better. Okay, so let's see how that can work. Okay, well, and they just point out one thing about this is that the natural time scale of the photon polarization measurement implies that you'd be sensitive to both daily and annual variations in the mode. Okay, because the point is that the typical interrogation time is a millisecond time scale. And so if you can measure, you know, many times, a millisecond, and the principal pack properties that would point into how it changes at all. Okay. But nevertheless, to realize a useful terrestrial experiment, one has to magnetize dark matter. And in this regard, okay, it's very useful to think about how we magnetize electrically, or rather polarize, matter with this electrically neutral, okay, which doesn't interact strongly. So I put to you that if we want to consider how to magnetize dark matter, we should understand how we polarize neutrons. Because if we can polarize neutrons, maybe we can polarize this too. And in fact, okay, this is a suggestion provided to me by Jeff Green, that yes, you can imagine polarizing dark matter, if it has a magnetic moment, okay, using exactly the same technology which is used to polarize ultra-cold neutrons at Los Alamos. Oh my goodness, we're going to do it using a longitudinal stereo lock device. Let me show it to you. This is on the UCNA beamline at Los Alamos. So the idea is that we produce ultra-cold neutrons. They do this here in a solid deuterium source. So you produce ultra-cold neutrons. Their typical kinetic energy is of order 10 to the minus 6 eV. They are extremely cold. Now, what happens is that the UCNs enter here. There's a very strong longitudinal magnetic field. And in this case, they use a 7 Tesla magnet. And the point is that the UCNs come in, they're unpolarized, but the right spin state sees it well, and the wrong spin state sees it barrier. So in fact, this longitudinal magnetic field acts as a Stern-Gerlach device. Only the right spin state neutrons actually enter the magnetic field region. So in this device, because ultra-cold neutrons really are ultra-cold, that in fact, this is a device which yields 99.9% polarization. So this is this, and interestingly, the only thing this relies upon is having a particle with a magnetic moment. So very well, so this is exactly how you might want, and so what's very natural about the experiment I would propose to you is that you imagine having a cavity. You're going to have your laser and the direction of the applied electromagnetic field be parallel in order to realize a Faraday experiment anyway. And so the point is that you're going to apply a strong magnetic field, and the liquid that comes through, well, then naturally is self-polarizing, because very slow, cold, very slow dark particles will not be able to enter, the wrong spin state will not be able to enter the experimental region. Now, I should emphasize that if dark matter, okay, but what's relevant is, in order to make any sort of practical estimate, is what is the typical wind velocity in the Earth rest frame. It turns out that for warm dark matter candidates that are consistent with sweeping, so they typically sweep in through the apparatus at 200 kilometers per second plus or minus 30, which is essentially the annual variation that we have due to the Earth rotating about the Sun, that in fact you're still only going to capture polarization fractions of maybe 10 to minus 6. Okay? The polarization efficacy is going strongly dependent on exactly what the velocity is in the Earth rest frame. So in this case, for this kind of experiment, you see a very large annual variation because of this polarization effect. What I'd like to do though is sort of put to you what the concept is for the terrestrial experiment. I'm working on finalizing the actual limits that can come out, and just say that what I've done for you today is consider the possibility of observing a dark matter candidate particle with a non-zero magnetic moment for this magnetic Faraday effect, and that this effect can serve an appreciable source of neutral polarization, and it can be studied terrestrially as well. And what I hope to do during my time here is to finalize my paper or finish my paper on the limits that emerge from the terrestrial experiment. And so if you want to hear a formal update towards the end of my month here, hopefully I can give you one. So that's it.